We're going to go back to Psalm 127 today. I've got my voice mostly back. It kind of cuts in and out every now and again if I try and go too high pitched here. I'm trying to keep a level, what do you call it? A monotone voice. Y'all, it's going to be a hard lesson today, but we're sure going to try. I did, however, print my notes today. So. At work. That's how far ahead I thought here. I'm pretty proud of myself. We're going to go ahead and read Psalm 127, verses 4 and 5, I think, is what we're going to focus on today. But just a quick recap. A couple weeks ago, I know it's been a while, so we're going to go over a quick recap here. We talked about the mighty man understanding who their commander is and what cause they fight for. You know, we talked about that this whole chapter here talks about the progression, you know, except the Lord build a house and they labor in vain that build it. And then, of course, we talk a lot about the arrows, which are the children of your youth, but we fail to focus on what all that depends upon. It depends upon what kind of man you are, if you're just simply a soldier or if you truly strive to be a mighty man. And that mighty man, a couple of concepts that surround that idea is they understand their commander and what cause they fight for. They don't just do what pleases themselves. They do what is pleasing to their first in command. They do what is meaningful and beneficial to the cause that they're involved in. They understand the crucial time that they're living in and what they do and how it affects the next step in that process, or the next generation, the next wave of attack, whatever you want to call it. They understand that what they do matters to the next part. We talked about how they are aware of their surroundings and what's going on. You know, they know what's going on in the world. They understand what's going on around them. They're not oblivious to what's happening, in the moment they're living in. And they understand the impact on what it could happen if they don't do this, or if they do this without watching this side. They understand that it's going to affect them, and it's going to affect others if they let it affect them. And so they know how to react, and how to react correctly, and so that what they do is not impeded and does not hold up the rest of everyone behind them or ahead of them. They're not deaf to the cries of the just, and they're not blind to the deeds of the wicked and the effect it has on our lives as Christians. Another point we made is how they know what weapons they have available. And we went over it is the armor of God. But they also understand that when they hold them, they understand how to wield them. They're not stupid. They understand when they hold a sword, you can't just swing it. We see a lot of movies now where just anybody can grab a sword and start swinging it, and they'll win the battle. They got women with arms smaller than mine swinging these big old broad swords across, and that just doesn't happen unless they're made of styrofoam, and then it's just like a pillow fight. It's not how it works. They understand that there's weight to these tools. There are ways you have to hold them, ways you have to swing them, certain circumstances where you cannot use them, but can use another weapon. They understand the shield is only important and only effective when used in the manner it is to be used, to be held up, not draped down, to be held firmly at their side, ready to be swung to block any incoming attack. They're not dumb when they hold their weapons, and they understand how many weapons they have available, because they don't just focus on one thing. They're not one-track minded. They understand the full armor of God instead of just one aspect of it. And they, I already went over that. We'll skip it. But today I'd like to capitalize on the subject that is usually spoken about. You know, growing up in Baptist churches, the only time you heard this chapter, you heard verses 3, 4, and 5. And usually it was on a really weird subject that it was brought into. And generally, it was focused on your children used as arrows and the damaging effect that it could have. However, I feel like there was a lot missed when I listened to these sermons. And going back and doing research for myself, I realized just how much was missed. I'm going to try and stay quick on it today, not be too long. But if you'll indulge me for a few minutes, I think you'll see this sort of like I do here. But verses 3, 4, and 5 say, "Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate." And I'd like to start off by saying I'm in no matter an expert in this. You know, I only got three young children, but what I am going to talk about is from the Bible and a little bit from the experience that's been passed on to me from people who have been successful with their kids. And just looking at what they've said and what the Bible says and how they line up, it really is pretty amazing, all this that I've seen today. Excuse me. I'd like to explore a little bit about the children of your youth. You know, notice it makes a point to mention the time in your life that you have children. And we've talked about this before, about the children of your youth. What is your youth? Your youth is not an age group per se. Your age is not a set number of years that you go through. But as our pastor usually explores, your youth is a stage that you're in until your children grow up. And then you come out of your youth and have to start that new stage of life and learning how to operate differently in that stage. So youth isn't particularly 18 to 35. Youth isn't particularly 18 to 25. It's not a set age group. It's not a set number. It's not a set maturity level. It's when your children become of age out of their childhood and into their youth that you end your youth. And so this time in your life, he's not putting years on that, because I've heard sermons where this is an appropriate verse to use to prove to have children while you're young, to get married while you're young. If you get married over 28, you're an old maid, just forget it. It's not going to work. That's how I've heard this verse preached before. However, that is not what he's saying. He said, excuse me, I can't hardly keep this down here. They are heritage of the Lord. Fruit of the womb is his rewards. And it says, so are the children of their youth. It's what they have done in their younger years, why you can bear children, to when they grow up. Because the focus on these arrows here are not while they're toddlers. They're not while they're in their childhood. It's not while they're 8, 9, and 10. They're only arrows when they grow up and are formed as arrows. And that's going to come in a little later here. So it's not particularly a length of time that he is saying you have to have kids and you have to do this like right now, or this verse does not apply to you. The Bible is not restricted to any one person, one age group, or one time of life. And this clearly shows what he means. And notice the comparison that is made here. The generation up until maturity, they're illustrated as arrows, while these older generation out of their youth are illustrated as mighty men. And then, of course, if you're reading the Proverbs, there's mighty men, then there's fools. There's two different categories. Make sure you're in the right one there. There's no middle ground. And so I just wanted to pull out a couple parallels here, and I just got 3 points, no poem, so we'll keep it short and sweet and just keep going there. But if you notice, he says, as arrows in the hand of a mighty man, so are the children of the youth. Happy is the man that has his quiver full of them. I don't know about you guys, but I've never seen a man of war or even a bow hunter that's happy with a quiver full of dull arrows. Bow season has already come up and gone pretty much, and what do you usually do when bow season comes up if you're a bow hunter? Well, you pick up your bow and you buy some arrows from Academy or Walmart or wherever you go, and then you go hunting. But that's not the way it really works. If you do some research in it, that's not the way it used to be. You know, back in the times where these are, of course, stepping back a little bit, and even the purest bow hunters still do it this way, they have to really work hard to get an arrow, one arrow. Excuse me. You had to go out and find materials, not just raw materials. That's all you had to work with. And when you found the right material for your arrows, you often had to mold them, trim them, and sometimes even put them under extreme duress to get them into the correct shape so that you can use them for your bow. And you draw a parallel that we do the same for our children. When we get children, they are a blank slate. They are raw material. And what you do with that raw material is absolutely important to what's going to happen next. When you have a child, obviously all they really want to do is eat, sleep, go to the bathroom, sleep some more, and eat some more. She's starting to wake up a little bit. I was messing with her this morning. She's starting to laugh a little bit. But I Googled it a little bit, and she's not really laughing, like belly laughing or nothing, but she's trying to laugh when you mess with her and play with her. They said that most kids don't laugh until they're like 3 months old. Like, don't even try starting to laugh. But they also said that research is partial to the parents who don't laugh a lot. How's about that? They said that 80% of parents surveyed only spend a maximum of 5 hours a day with their baby because of daycare and work and everything else like that. 20% had a babysitter that wasn't invested in the child. 45% had one that barely played with the baby, just took care of its basic needs. And the ones that, the other whatever percent, so I think I'm left with 65, so that's like 35%. That's right. Had really invested babysitters who played with them. They went really in depth here. Because why do only that percentage of babies start trying to smile and laugh and play that early? It's because of the people in their lives showing them how to live life. Most of them showed them that all life was about was laying on their head, getting a real flat spot because they're laying there so much. And they don't threaten, I mean, they never smile at them, they never tickle them, they never mess with them. If they're awake, they're in a swing. And if they're asleep, they're in a bed. And if they're hungry, usually they're held and then they're put right back down. Because you're not supposed to teach a child that it wants to be held anymore. So you never hold it. And the result is sadder babies. The result is less joy in our children. The result is whinier children, more irritable children. So if that doesn't prove that the raw material we're given, they don't just develop their own personality based on what's in their little head when they're born. It's based off of who they're around, how you treat them, what you tell them, and how much you smile at them. I spend a lot of time smiling at the baby when she's not up at 2 to 4 in the morning. And even then, it's kind of, last night I played with her for like 30 minutes because she was just up and so happy. And how do you do that? But that's the way it works. When I tickled her this morning, she grinned real big and like tried to laugh. Because we're always laughing at her, usually. And Dorothy's always laughing at her. So these children are raw material that you're putting stuff into. You're putting work into these children one way or another. You're teaching them it's okay to laugh, or that life is supposed to be joyful, or that we're joyful, or you're teaching them that life's a real bummer and that's always going to be that way. Might as well start early. The popular opinion is to let them find their own way with God. And this starts as an early, quote-unquote, soul-searching experience from early adulthood, which they start at like 8 years old now in church, all the way up until they're teenagers where you get pizza parties. Pizza parties do make me happy, so I'm not against them. However, if that's what your ministry is about, that's probably not the way we need to go. This is allowed by giving their freedom. This letting them find their own way. You give them their freedom and let the church help guide them in their spiritual walk to Christ and with Christ. I read a really nice teen church handbook this week in preparation for this message. And there was so much in there about how to guide them on their way, but most of it was don't tell them what to do. They said, if the Bible says it, give it to them and let them see if it works for them. The best way to guide them in Christ is to give them the words of Christ and nothing else. I agree with that. But to give them the words of Christ without the understanding that we have of what it means and the context of what it means, how are you going to guide anybody in the way of Christ? Especially teenagers that don't even know which way's up. They don't know what shoes they want to wear tomorrow. How are they supposed to know which way to go? Arrows were never formed by leaving them outside in the tent and letting them get themselves in the best shape for battle. These materials that you found that you had to trim, shape, straighten out, sometimes put over fire to harden them so they would not lose shape, was never meant to be left in the tent until it's time to run out and go to the battle. There's only one way to shape up the material, and that is for us to use what we have learned from the Master and pass it on to them. As we were taught, when we were shaped, we are supposed to shape them and show them what it means to be a mighty man. Pass the skill, the knowledge, and the wisdom on to the next generation so that they have a real fighting chance of flying straight and doing damage to the enemy. Number two, arrows, no matter how straight you can make them, don't do any good unless they have the right adjustments to fly and land where they're meant to land. How many of us take a blank arrow and fire it, hoping to drop that big deer this season? I don't know anyone here bow hunts, but generally we know what we're talking about when it comes to that. Well, I would hope that nobody would take a blank arrow out that we've straightened out and fire it and hope to drop something huge. This is a serious matter of knowing enough about the blank arrow to know what he needs to remain level and fly true. Arrows are one of those things where one feather can ruin your shot. Arrows are one of those things that once you straighten them, make them the right length, trim them up, make the right diameter, all that good stuff. You put it on your finger, it balances. It's the perfect shaft for an arrow. But it's not the perfect arrow. It's the beginnings of an arrow. What do you need to do when you make an arrow? Generally, when you put it on your finger and it balances one way or the other, you know if it's top heavy or bottom heavy, trim it out to where it's absolutely level. But that doesn't mean it's going to fly true. You're supposed to take, you know, a lot of times we use those wings, the styrofoam wings we put on there now. But it used to be you take feathers and put them spiraling a certain direction to angle the wind so that it did nothing but stay true. And then there was a little weight you had to put on the back because, of course, you put a broadhead on the front to pierce the enemy, the deer, whatever you're getting. We equip arrows with feathers on the back as a counter to the wind. And we put arrowheads on them to ensure that when they hit their mark, they stay with it and don't fall off. Another interesting fact about arrowheads is they used to be carved from a rock. And they were very hard to work on. You had to sharpen them, you had to keep them sharp. And you may notice that a lot of people collect arrowheads today because the people from our ancestors made those arrowheads to last. And when they put them on that arrow was going to last. The correct arrowhead won't fade and will be remembered for generations to come. So, to take your children and not equip them properly, making sure they have whatever they need on the back to resist the winds of doctrine from knocking them off course, and the correct arrowhead on the front to be able to pierce their target and stay with it, is very important. What are you equipping your children with, if anything at all? Are you giving them the word, or are you giving them your words? Are you putting them something on the back to help guide them? And you notice it's on the back end what guides them. What's on the back end of our lives? Our young father, our grandfather, whoever we may have met along the way, all that and what we tell them helps guide them one way or the other, whether it keeps them on course or whether they put it on there wrong and it knocks you off course continuing. Excuse me. And finally, The straightest, most well-equipped arrow won't fly if we don't know what we're doing with the bow. I see a lot of fail videos with people with a compound bow pulling it back when, well, usually they're pulling it up like this, and then they lift it up like this, and when they let it go, the arrow just goes poink and right straight down, and the string snaps them in the hand, and it's actually pretty funny. However, how often are we that way? How many people do we see that know everything about it, have the perfect arrow, they have the most expensive bow, and they tout it around, and they know what they're doing, they know how to use their bow, and they're just the best at it than probably anybody who's ever walked this earth. But when you get out there to help them shoot it, they're using their feet to pull it up, and then they're like struggling to hold it there while they pull it up, and then when they finally, they're shaking just as hard as they can, when they finally let it go, nothing happens. Supremely anticlimactic. How many of us are like that? We have an amazing head knowledge of what we believe, and we're stuck on doing it a certain way because there are always pros on bow hunting. But we really don't know why we believe that way or how to use it. And this is me saying firsthand knowledge. Now, kids don't care what you're saying unless you show that you believe it and know that there's a reason that you believe it. I've seen a lot of head knowledge Christians that live at church one way, speak at church one way, and they get home and their kids don't believe a word they say because they're just total switch. And it goes back to the first lesson, that you have to believe that Jesus is King of Kings and that you live like that, that you live knowing that He's coming back one day. As you live knowing that He's your Savior and that He's real and He's not at church, He's with you every day. Part of the reason that we have what we have going on in churches is that we live with Christ in the church, not Christ in your home. We live that Christ is on the way to church in your car with that little CD with 37 tracks that you can listen to in one trip. But He's not in your home. You hear nothing about Him. You know nothing about Him. Until you go to church, then you know everything about Him. When you get to that range, finally, because you talk to everybody and tell them how well you know how to use this thing, and then when you finally go to the range to shoot your arrow that you've worked so hard on, you fail. It's something you really can't describe with words. It has to be something you live. A burning fire that's in your soul because of the living Son of God. The man holding the bow and the arrow has to have it sighted in at all times. You ultimately launch your kids off into whatever life they're going to have. You prepare them for the life that they're going to live. And you prepare them with this word right here. How you make the arrow, how you equip the arrow, is all in how you raise them. Whether you raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, or whether you do whatever you want with them and kind of just halfway do it. But none of that means anything if you don't know how to use your bow. How to sight in the bow. A lot of people, this is their biggest thing. They go out, they got your little whisker biscuit. I mean, they've got it. I mean, it's a laser sight on there. And they click the thing on, and you see it hit the deer, that little green dot there, and then they shoot their bow, and it runs into the tree 30 foot from them. Why is that? Because we know how to point a laser, but we don't know how to sight in a bow. We don't know how to use what we got. We're not paying attention to the wind, because there's plenty of wind. You must be steady and unintimidated by the enemy, because you know your cause is His cause, and His cause is true. When you let go of that arrow to let it fly, you have to know that you've done everything you could to let it hit its mark. And you have to know that you've done what you can do to do lasting damage to the enemy. And a lot of those archers did what they did in order to give light during time of battle at night. Because sometimes there was an arrowhead, and sometimes they made adjustments and wrapped something around it where they could light a fire on it. Just enough to fly through and land and give light while they were marching on. So, no matter what you do with your arrow, how you equip it and how you shoot it, it's going to mean life or death for the people ahead of you. We always say that children are a light to a time that we'll never see. Ambassadors to a time they'll never see. More importantly, you have to know that you've given it your all to make sure that arrow flies straight and true to its purpose. These children will speak with the enemy in the gate. They haven't given up ground. They haven't given up hope. They haven't given up the cause. They're still at it. Because you cannot anymore. One of these days, all of us will not be able to do what we're doing today. Whether it's preaching or whether it's preaching in general, like legal wise. What are your children going to do? Do they know there is a cause, or do they know we just come to church because it's the right thing to do? If coming to church is just the right thing to do, that's all it'll ever be to them. In the end, children do want to do right. But they don't always have to know why they're doing right for them to do it, because it makes their conscience feel better. Do they know there's a cause? Do they know they have a purpose? Do they know their purpose in life? Do they know why they're being launched out into this world and why we put such rigorous training on them to try and prepare them for what's coming next? Or are they just sent out there to land and sit there and wonder why they landed there? An arrow unsure of its mark will never be of any lasting effect. You don't aspire wildly into the sky or into the woods and hope for the best. There is a mark to be hit. Do you know the mark? Do you know how to hit that mark? Are you skilled enough, or are you becoming skilled enough to be able to launch it effectively to where it needs to go? Have you made your arrows while neglecting your bow sights? Or do you know what needs to be done to drive this cause forward? Children are the future, whether you like it or not. We are the past. We may be the present right now, but we are quickly becoming the past. What are you doing to further the future?